Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season two is out now from Lemonada Media.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
Welcome back. This is SiriusXM Progress. John Fugelsang. And, you know, throughout the years of Donald Trump's hate mongering and racism and sexual abuse of women and lies and corruption and ending the peaceful transfer of power, our next guest has been a consistent, grounded voice of both sanity and urgency with so much at stake. This is a scary time for America. The rights of women and transgender people are being rolled back. The truth about Black history and the experience are being silenced. Unrestricted gun violence is on the rise, and Christians are cheering the opposite of what they claim to believe in. But through it all, this next guest, Pastor John Pavlovitz, has been there reminding us to be outraged, but never to hate. Pastor John Pavlovitz is a writer and an activist. He lost his church once speaking up for the rights of LGBTQ parishioners. He is a 25-year veteran in the trenches of local church ministry. He's committed to equality, diversity, and justice. He has a great blog that's called Stuff That Needs to Be Said. It reaches a huge worldwide audience, over 100 million views. And his books include A Bigger Table, Stuff That Needs to Be Said, and If God Is Love, Don't Be a Jerk. He currently directs the Empathetic People Network, which is an online community that connects people from all over the world who want to create a more compassionate world. And John Pavlovitz's new book is called Worth Fighting For: Finding Courage and Compassion When Cruelty is Trending. It is a book with compassion and guts, and it is just perfect for the smart, moral person in your life. It's a great pleasure to welcome Pastor John Pavlovitz back to SiriusXM.
Hey, John. So good to see you, my friend.
Thank you so much. Thanks for being with us. I admire the work you do. I am always grateful anytime we can get you on the show. This book is a book about fighting, and it's a book about love. And it really, in going through it, it's a book for the weary. You know, I often say that what we're dealing with now is what I call what the fuck fatigue. Our outrage circuits are burned out, and we're dealing with whatever happened 25 what the fucks ago. And people are just overwhelmed with it. And this book really is, in many ways, the book that a lot of people, believers and non-believers alike, have been waiting for. I have to ask you, what inspired this particular work, sir?
Well, John, doing the work that I've been doing, it's allowed me to travel throughout the country for the past really nearly a decade. And I consider myself now not primarily an author or a pastor or a speaker, but a collector of stories, a war correspondent. And this book is really the product of sitting with people in quiet moments throughout this country and hearing their exhaustion, hearing them try to figure out, when do I fight for my convictions and when do I fight for my relationships, and how to just carry a grief that we really shouldn't be able to carry. You know, it's this accumulated heartache from just so much that we've been immersed in. So it's really for the weary, to help them kind of keep going.
I completely agree with you. You know, we've talked a lot in the past about how when someone you love or a relative or a coworker, they can fall into the Trump cult. And I don't mean to be offensive to cults in saying that. I'm very sorry if any cults are offended by me using that word. John, you have a terrific piece in here about the mental health crisis of MAGA America that I marvel at your wit, because it manages to be both scathing and yet deeply compassionate at the same time. I don't know how you pull that off. But is that what you think it is? Do you really think it is a mental health crisis? I want to believe that it's that and not just 80 million character flaws coalescing.
Well, in my more pessimistic moments, I probably do lean that way, too. But when I look at the relational fractures, which is really what we're talking about, you know, theology and politics all settles down into our neighborhoods and kitchen tables and friendships. And that's where I see a group of people who have embraced something. Maybe it's a small, there's a million small concessions in our moral kind of fiber. And I think over time, what that does is, you know, as someone who struggles with depression and anxiety, I have lived my life having difficulty, but it didn't have to have something that I could name in front of me. In other words, I didn't have to have objective data to tell me that I should feel terrible. And yet now, decent people are looking around and saying, well, objectively, there's a lot to be terrified by and a lot to grieve over. So people who are already unhealthy are struggling, and people who really never had predisposition to this despair are experiencing it. And worst of all, probably, John, are that Trump followers are being exploited and their fears are being leveraged. And so they're in a state of perpetual terror. So really nobody is mentally at their best right now.
I mean, we know plenty of friends on the left side who are in a perpetual state of marked agitation. We can see with plenty of our friends on the left side how that is just not a healthy way to be, regardless of where your convictions lie.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to get your bearings, to make really good decisions. And again, you know, relationally, this is where it breaks down, because we are so pushed into these tribal places that anywhere of nuance or anywhere of complexity is almost getting squeezed out. And I think a lot of that is because Trump has asked for that all or nothing loyalty. And so we are being kind of, these battle postures are just so much a part of our daily lives, and we weren't really designed to live this way.
There's also, of course, you know, the factor of a right-wing media machine that is meant to perpetuate constant umbrage, constant outrage. It's not solutions-oriented. Yep. It's not working-together-oriented. It's how the 1% maintains power now. The rage of the 99% keeps the 1% in their perch. But you know, I don't mean to say that some people vote for Donald Trump. You talk about incrementally, and yeah, people overlook it. The first time, well, I can get past the sexual assault and the stealing from the vets with the fake school, and I can get past the racist stuff about the first black president, and eventually you make so many moral concessions, you don't know who you are or what you stand for anymore. You just know this tribal allegiance. And is it fair to say it's a cult, John? I mean, there's people who they vote for him because they don't like abortion or something. But at some point, a lot of them do fall into this notion where they believe he's a good person. They believe he's innocent of his crimes. They believe he's a good businessman. I call him the brand swallowers. Is it fair to say that they're a cult, or they are our neighbors and our cousins and our friends who have been mentally hijacked?
Well, I think it's a mix of people who have been, as you said, slowly they lose their bearings and they get to the point where they can't even recognize, especially Christians, the mission drift that they've been victimized by, that they are following something that is antithetical to the heart of the Jesus they claim to worship. But yet, so there's that. And then there's also a group of people who are really taking the power grab and saying, this is going to get me what I want. Really, Donald Trump and the evangelical church are using one another. And it's really going to be about who's going to break down first or who's going to pull away. And I think, you know, keeping people in a perpetual state of fear, the worst of religion, the worst of politics, it relies on always having an adversary, needing an encroaching enemy. And so that's that. When you get a group of people that are, I always say, no one's at their best when they're terrified. And so it is cultic, but it's cultic because people are in a state of fear.
So, I mean, you talk in the book about loving toxic people from a distance, which actually seems like a really smart way of framing it, that you want to always give love, but you also always need to protect yourself.
Yeah, I think, you know, John, we look at what love is. And as a person raised in the Christian faith, I've got these commands to love my neighbor, love the least, love my enemies. And how do I do that when they are in these kind of confrontational positions, these orientations. And I think loving someone from a distance means you can disagree vehemently with them and love them from a distance in that you can still humanize them. And I think dehumanization is what the right has really trafficked in, and we don't want to become that. So I don't soften my language. I don't change my convictions, but I see the other human being across from me, try to have whatever measure of dignity and respect I can have, and then realize, though, that may mean we still have irreconcilable moral differences.
That's fascinating to me, because you actually have an essay called Messy Community in here that I think should be done many times and filmed. And you had this really diverse table gathering you moderated in California. And I want to ask you if you could share this experience with our listeners, as well as what the legs of the table were that were non-negotiable for how people had to conduct themselves. What was the idea behind this, and who did you invite?
Well, when A Bigger Table was written, which was my first book, we wanted to talk about creating spiritual community among disparate people where everyone could be seen and heard and respected. And it was really partially a response to the 2016 election and looking at things like hospitality and diversity and agenda-free community. So we had this gathering in California where a gentleman said, I'm going to host this. I've got a group of people from my more orthodox conservative Christian past, and I've got my progressive friends now. And so he invited them all together, and we began having this conversation, and it started off well. And then it quickly got really messy, and you started to see people's places of prejudice come out, people's phobias, the past traumas being re-exposed. And so I had to sort of moderate this really uncomfortable conversation. And then I stayed a couple days and had some follow-up with different people. And what I realized was, if we could have done this over time, we really could have built something that was sustainable and that allowed people to gather with some measure of difference in a really humane and productive way. And so I challenge people all the time to do that and see if they can find, create communities that don't exist right now, venues that we really don't have. You know, traveling the country, I'm invited to speak by progressive Christian churches and synagogues and mosques and humanist conferences and atheist events, but never by a conservative Christian church. Yeah. And I think that is where the breakdown is. They just don't want that conversation.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you'd think that maybe they would, maybe even just to have someone to heckle. And I never see, Bernie Sanders went to speak to Liberty University. I think that's about the only time I can think of anyone in recent years who's been welcomed into that kind of lion's den.
Yeah, and because when the leaders of those churches know, if we have a conversation that is actually respectful and rational and people make, you know, decent points, there's going to be a lot of questioning. So people like you and me, we've gone through the existential crisis of asking hard theological questions, but people in those churches, the leaders don't want them to have them, or the people there just want a lazy shorthand faith. And so they will avoid conversation because they don't want to deal with the fallout, which is losing some of your old story, grieving what you've lost, and then actually changing the way you live. And a lot of people don't want to do that, sadly.
Now, your table gathering, you said the legs of the table were hospitality, authenticity, diversity, and relationship. Can you break that down for me a little bit? Those are the four legs of the table.
Yeah, for certain. You know, I started going back, John, to the table ministry of Jesus, all the stories in the Gospels where Jesus uses the breaking of bread, the sharing of a meal with people to let them know they're seen and heard and respected. And I looked at all those stories, and those were some of the themes that there was this hospitality, this welcome that transcended what was comfortable for most people. There was a diverse gathering. You know, he met with priest and with prostitute. He meets with the religious elite and the street rabble, and he meets them in a place where they're allowed to be fully who they are. He often knows their story, and yet he still wants to, he's respecter of the person. He sees the individual. They all leave him with their dignity intact. And then the agenda-free community part is really about, can we love people without needing to fix or change or save or renovate them, which, as you know, is so much of what the conservative church is about. So it's really about modeling a sense of welcome and inclusion and community that and relationship that is based on what the teachings of Jesus actually are, as opposed to what the evangelical church has now created them to be.
Oh yeah, I want to get to that. But you said that the event went, you said it was messy but not ugly, right? That's America on a good day, John, isn't it? Messy but not ugly. That's all I'm hoping for at this point.
Well, yeah, somebody said, why did you call your last book, If God is Love, Don't Be a Jerk, and not If God is Love, Love Others? I said, because my expectations for humanity have become very pedestrian. And that's true. You know, we were all in a room together, and that made it very difficult. You know, that physical proximity really helps. And especially the other thing is when people come with an agenda, or at least try to be in a posture of curiosity and have the humility to say, I'm willing to be shown that I'm wrong. And if we have a couple of those things, then at least we can disagree and people can leave that realizing that they are respected as human beings. And so I do have hope that those things can work out. It's just there aren't a lot of venues where that can get lived out.
It's really true. I say all the time, when it comes to broadcasting, only in sports talk can you see people who disagree passionately have a fight and they still get along and it's still good natured. It's like the news is hardwired to be afraid of vigorous debate that can avoid being toxic. Only sports does it, I think.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And I think we've conditioned ourselves, even in the church, you know, even in some of the best churches I was a part of, there was the feeling that disagreement or disruption or conflict was somehow always bad. And the truth is, the things that we're talking about, again, they're theology and politics, but they're really human beings and that we deeply care about on no matter what side we fall on. So there's bound to be passionate responses. And so we should at least be able to bear with the convictions of the person across from us. I try to remember that someone's theology and politics on the other side was formed, it's not unlike mine, through years and years of experiences and voices that were spoken into me. And I try to respect the story, even if I don't agree with the conclusions.
You have to respect it until you bury it with facts and hopefully a brutally witty riposte at the end. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Pastor John Pavlovitz.
Right.
His new book is called Worth Fighting For, Finding Courage and Compassion When Cruelty is Trending. You have a section in the book called How to Talk About Your Religious Beliefs and Not Be a Total Asshole, which I love because that's what you do. I've never once heard you say anything about your faith or its context that would alienate a non-believer or someone from a different faith. It's not that hard to do when you go into it with humility, right? If you just talk about what your holy book says and what you believe rather than what the absolute truth is and what you're imposing, people will be more open.
Well, you know, John, my story was that really I was the product of, I got better stories about people that I had false stories about. And I was fortunate to have experiences and meet people who altered, you know, I say life began to argue with my theology. And I had the choice then to either lean into that new information or to double down. And for some reason, I leaned into the new stories, the new information. And so I've always tried to speak as someone who both fights with and for the faith tradition that he came out of. And because of that, I don't feel beholden to staying with it or to being in lockstep with it. And also because at the end of it, John, if God is God, then God is not intimidated by my questions or my doubts or my vacillation. Only insecure Christians are.
Boom. Oh, boom. I mean, you say we believe that social justice is the heart of the gospel, that it was the central work of Jesus as evidenced in his life and teachings, the checking of power, the healing of wounds, the care for the poor, the lifting of the marginalized, the feeding of the hungry, the making of peace. I mean, if you go by what's in the book, he's arguably the most progressive figure in history or literature, whatever one believes. What kind of pushback have you gotten, Pastor, to that kind of thinking?
Well, sadly, you know, I think what we have now, John, is a Jesus-less Christianity that, you know, Republicans are holding on to, which is why they will, when they talk about religion, they'll always use God or the Bible in general terms, but never specifically use the Sermon on the Mount or any of the teachings of Jesus, because they can superimpose their values on the idea of God. They can use that as an avatar for themselves, but they can't really screw with the words of Jesus. And so the more I put those words out there, the more they have to deal with them, and the greater the disconnect, you know, appears to people outside of it. So that's, you know, really what we're finding.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine. I follow you on social media, and I see the kind of things your fans say, that in so many cases you have given comfort and even sanity and grounding to people who were raised believing that Christianity was supposed to be this nice religion about love and forgiveness and compassion, and grew up to find this moral majority, Jerry Falwell, mean little nasty provincial cult that their faith had turned into. That's got to be the best part of your job, I would imagine, the kind of opening of the heart from so many people who, it's easy to feel gaslit and insane by these right wingers.
Yeah, for sure, John. And I've been just, it's a privilege to be able to do what I do and realize that I am a hub for people who feel homeless in the, you know, religion that they grew up in, or they're not religious at all, but they have an affinity with some of the things that I talk about. So I love that there's this very odd congregation that has gathered around the writing, and it's a beautiful thing to be able to sort of connect them and let them know, you know, you have community in one another, and that we do have to work together to kind of overcome this really toxic, hateful expression of Christianity.
So then let me close, Pastor, with $1 million question. Your book is called Worth Fighting For. Why is this America, this version of America that we're living in one quarter of the way through this century, why is this America worth fighting for? Why is it worth saving?
Well, I think we have two kinds of Americas, John. We have an aspirational one and an incarnational one. We have the America, the idea, as Bono says, this beautiful idea that could be. And I think people like you and people like me, we've seen flashes of it. And I think when I look back and I see people say, why do you stay hopeful? And I say, I stay hopeful for Anne Frank and people like that who existed in these horrible times in history and yet persevered, had this defiant joy. And I think that's our job right now. People are going to inherit whatever we leave them. And so it's in the choices we make today. So that's worth fighting for, those who are going to follow us and deserve to have something worth inheriting.
Pastor John Pavlovitz's new book is Worth Fighting For: Finding Courage and Compassion When Cruelty is Trending. Pastor, what is the best way for our listeners to follow you and learn more about the book and more about the work you do? Because you're like a social media rock star. You're one of the reasons I won't quit Twitter.
Well, thank you, John. Well, John Pavlovitz, there aren't a lot of us around. So Pavlovitz, spell my last name. You can find me on Substack, on the blog, on all the socials. But I just appreciate you, John, and all that you do, and looking forward to getting some time with you again in the future.
Come back anytime. It's going to be a crazy election year, and I always appreciate what you do. John, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. I'm glad we both missed the rapture.
Yeah. Well, we're working on it over here. We had the earthquake and the eclipse. I'm ready for the frogs. We'll be right back on SiriusXM.
That's
Progress.
Right.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Okay. Kathy Castor is Tampa Bay's voice in the U.S. Congress. She was elected in 2006 and represents Florida's 14th Congressional District, which includes Tampa and St. Petersburg. I'm a big fan of the Ybor City Improv myself. She's the first woman to represent Hillsborough and Pinellas counties in the U.S. Congress. She's ranking member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee's Powerful Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee. And here's why she's a rock star. In 2022 alone, Representative Castor secured a record-setting $10 million in aid, benefits, and refunds to veterans, seniors, and small businesses and families. And thanks to the American Rescue Plan and President Biden, Representative Castor delivered $206 million in tax cuts for most families and children. And just 3 years ago, her office worked to deliver almost $3 billion in COVID-19 grants to support small businesses and nonprofits. It is a great pleasure to welcome Representative Kathy Castor to SiriusXM.
Hey, John, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. So I have to say, in 2020, you, led by you, the Democratic members of the former House Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, unveiled this amazing comprehensive plan full of detailed, ambitious, actionable climate solutions that Congress should enact to benefit American families and communities across the country. In December of 22, the committee released their final report, which lays out the historic success of that's happened since the release of the Climate Crisis Action Plan. Why should our media be talking about this instead of all the nonsense they cover? It seems that the work you've done on the climate crisis affects every level of our society, from business to insurance to public health.
You bet it does. And we believe that American leadership and ingenuity are central to solving the climate crisis. Climate now is raising costs on families, high electric bills. And people are, they understand climate like never before. They are experiencing the impacts of extreme heat, the floods, more intense storms. I mean, month of March 2024 was another month, another record. For the 10th month in a row, we broke global heat records. Mm-hmm. There's no end in sight unless we work together to lower greenhouse gas pollution and give people the solutions in their lives that are meaningful.
Now, of course, everyone in this country is affected in some way by climate change, but I got to say, the good people of Florida and in your district up by Tampa are likely to experience some of the most serious impacts of our warming planet. And I'm curious, how would you like to see the Congress moving forward address the issue? And how, more specifically, would you like to see Florida become a leader in climate action? I know you have your Republican colleagues over here who are resistant, but I'm sure the local businesses care a lot.
John, you know, did you hear that they're thinking about going to a Category 6 hurricane ranking?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Five was
yeah.
always.
I mean, the oceans are getting warmer. The evidence is in.
Yeah, the Gulf of Mexico, the Keys, the water was so hot, it was jacuzzi hot last summer. And that impacts everyone. That impacts our economy. We rely on clean water, clean beaches, tourism. So the beauty is that with President Biden's help, the Congress finally took action. We passed the Inflation Reduction Act. It is our historic clean energy law that gives people real tools to buy that electric car, move their kids in electric school buses, help them go solar, help them purchase those energy efficient appliances, the new air conditioners. This is economy wide and it is just beginning. In fact, there was some good news where emissions were slightly down, but America wants to lead the way. We're not in this alone. We need our allies across the globe, all countries across the globe, to implement these solutions. And I'm hopeful more than I have been in the past.
Are you hopeful that you can see Florida in some ways become a national leader?
We're the Sunshine State. But unfortunately, Governor DeSantis has his head in the sand. And the special interest are very powerful utility monopolies, keeping us hooked on gas. That's why the tools in the Inflation Reduction Act to work from the grassroots level to help people save money on their electric bills through energy efficiency, weatherization, going solar, That's going to be key. Right now, we have to work from the grassroots level. But other states across the country have good partners, good leadership in their governor's offices, and they are taking advantage of it. We don't have time to waste. This is urgent, and we've got to move away from fossil fuels and help put money back into people's pockets.
I must ask, Representative, do your Republican colleagues privately confide to you ever that they get it, that they do understand the science and the risks on this issue?
More and more, yes, they do. They're really just a handful of folks who will still debate that the climate isn't changing or humans and the burning of fossil fuels isn't at the heart of the problem. But what they say is, gosh, we can't do this. Look at China. China is continues to burn fossil fuels. So why should we put ourselves at a disadvantage? Well, mm-hmm. It's not a disadvantage. We want to lead with our technology. We want to build the electric vehicles. We want to put people to work. And the interesting thing is right now, a lot of those investments on where batteries and clean energy technologies and electric vehicles are being built are in those red districts. So that's gotten
right.
their attention over the past year for sure.
Yeah, it's gotten my attention seeing them all try to take credit for the funding. I would be most remiss if I didn't ask about the very eventful week we saw in Florida last week, where we're now going to see the go-ahead to have a six-week ban on abortion in your state. Men have made that choice for women. At the same time, we are seeing a ballot measure that would make abortion a protected right for the state of Florida, which I can only imagine is going to be very exciting for Democratic turnout. How did you feel about that very rapid 1-2 punch we experienced?
You know, Florida has a right to privacy in our Constitution that was put in back in the 80s that everyone thought, the courts interpreted, mm-hmm. that included the right to make your own health care decisions and the right to abortion. So the courts have been stacked over time by Rick Scott, Ron DeSantis, and they now have upheld this very extreme six-week abortion ban. That's a ban before most women even know they are pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, kind of a surprise, they did allow our constitutional amendment for abortion rights to go onto the ballot, and it now has set the state on fire. The turnout is going to be massive in Florida. We are going to have to make sure that vote by mail is safe and secure. They're fiddling around with that too. But I think the turnout for folks who are turned off by politics, especially the DeSantis brand of politics, they will be more engaged than ever.
Absolutely. I'm curious if your Republican colleagues have ever privately confided in you that they understand what a loser repealing Roe v. Wade has been. It certainly seems like our Republican loved ones are realizing between IVF and then mifepristone and now what we've witnessed this week in Arizona that this was very unpopular, including among the majority of American Christians.
For the most part, John, no. My next-door neighbor in Florida, in the Tampa Bay area, she calls herself an extremist when it comes to abortion, that she believes in that abortion ban, that she is very happy that there is a six-week ban and is discounting the constitutional amendment that is on our ballot. Most of them are just trying to avoid the issue. And, you know, even you heard the former president say, contort himself this week and say,
correct.
It's up to the states. And that's what we intended all along.
Can I ask, Representative, how do you and your anti-abortion rights neighbor generally get along?
I try to find common ground with everyone, and I've tried to do that especially on environmental issues because the health of the Gulf of Mexico and clean beaches is central to our way of life in Florida, and have tried to build that bridge.
Representative, she's very lucky to have a neighbor like you. My dad was a liberal who got along just fine with his Florida conservative neighbors, and we don't see enough of that. Kathy Castor, it's a real honor to have you with us. Please come back again. This platform is always open to you. How might our listeners find out more about your office and the topics you're fighting for?
Hey, follow me on Twitter, US Rep K Castor, and House.com. caster.gov.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks, John. Cheers.
Peace. We'll be right back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And welcome back. I am so delighted to finally have Lindy Lee on the show. I've been stalking her from afar for quite a while, trying to get her, and she's going to be joining us on stage next weekend at the Sexy Liberal Show with Stephanie Miller and me in Philadelphia, so I'm really thrilled we were able to get her here. For those of you who don't know, Lindy is a political commentator and strategist for MSNBC and CNN. She is a social media powerhouse, and I pity the fool who goes up against her. In 2023, Governor Josh Shapiro appointed Ms. Lee to the Governor's Advisory Commission on Asian Americans, in which capacity she advises the governor on matters important to the AAPI community. She was a DNC delegate for President-elect Biden. She's the longest-serving female class president in Princeton University's history. I was only class president for maybe about 2.5 weeks, and then they realized they'd made a terrible mistake. And not to bury the lead, but this morning she was backstage with President Biden. It is a great pleasure to welcome Lindy Lee, whose day began with Biden and ends with us. Welcome. It's great to have you.
John, it's such a pleasure to have you. I knew it was going to be therapeutic as soon as you slid into my DMs. I knew it was going to be great. So thank you so much for reaching out.
That's great. Usually when I slide into a woman's DMs, she calls HR. So I'm very, very glad you didn't.
No, I get good vibes from you, John. I've always trusted you. I've always trusted you from afar, so thank you for having me. This is a perfect way to end the day.
Thank you.
Well, oh, the night is young. This is the middle of the day for me.
This is the middle of the day for me. It's just part of my job being a charming sociopath, Lindy. Tell us about your morning.
Hey, you and me
President
both.
President Biden was in town. We were playing a bit of his speech earlier. Tell us about the event and your time backstage.
Well, I was invited backstage a month ago, so I had no expectations about this because there's a policy of not having someone go back to back, but behind, and it's a photo line. So you get to meet, there's a reception, you get to meet privately the president and speak. And I was just, my expectations were so low, but then I got an ominous text from the campaign manager. She's like, Lindy, can you meet me alone, like emphasis alone, in the lobby? And I was speaking with a friend next to me. I was like, oh my God, what did I do? There was no context in the text. And turns out the president wanted me to join him backstage. So it was such a pleasant surprise because it broke policy of, you know, having backed consecutive photo lines, you know, having the same person photo line twice. It's been so soon that I hadn't even gotten the photo from the last time. So yeah, it was such an honor. And I'm an immigrant, so I'm just like pinching myself. I've been pinching myself all day. And I was just speaking with somebody like, how did I get here? Like, how did this happen? This is like insane.
I mean, how did this happen? But how did this happen? This is because of your activism. And it's because you're someone who could just, you know, quietly plug away at making America better. But you have taken to social media. To me, you're one of the more inspiring influencers. You are fearless and you bring logic and passion to every debate you're in. And I think, you know, when they talk about how is Biden going to get reelected, what's the strategy when the mainstream media and these polls seem to just really want their Trump sized ratings back? I think it's going to be intelligent people like yourself who are passionate on social media, reminding people of what's at stake here.
And also hilarious and brilliant people like you. So thank you. You literally do this day in and day out, and also 11 p.m. at night. So we definitely need warriors like you. And also polls are turning around. I was speaking with somebody from the campaign today. We're in the middle of a comeback. Like, this is, we're definitely, the trajectory is pointing upwards. I can feel it. It's definitely palpable. The polls show it. Pennsylvania mm-hmm. certainly indicates it. This is Biden country. I've been here all my life. So I understand Philadelphia and the collar counties in and out. I'm from the suburban counties. I know. Like, I kind of, he can just sense it in the air, like the way that people talk.
Yeah.
And I think the criminal trial, it puts Trump's divisiveness, nefarious nature, complete psychopathy on full display.
Yeah.
And not to mention
I agree.
Children falling asleep.
I completely agree. And I think the falling asleep was a nice little sprinkle on this first week of a Sunday of Donald Trump. I mean, we're just talking about jury selection right now, but you know very well in the next couple of weeks when this thing really starts and testimony is logged, the American people are going to hear from Michael Cohen. They're going to hear from Stormy Daniels. They're going to hear from that guy, David Pecker, at the National Enquirer.
Yeah,
the facts are going to be laid out. I'm sorry?
His name, Pecker, perfect for this case.
Well, my name's Fuglesang. I'm not allowed to make fun of any other guy's last name ever.
Okay.
So I got to demur on that one. But I mean, essentially, we are, you know, I'm trying to shift my language and stop calling it a hush money case and start to more properly call it a campaign finance fraud case, because that is what it is. And I think, Lindy, that as more and more people become aware of this, it's not going to help him. He'll raise money off the rubes for a while off of this case, but he's not going to be getting any new fans from this. And he's going to lose some Republicans, not just the Nikki Haley kinds, but plenty of Republicans who tell these same pollsters they support him unless he's convicted.
Absolutely. You're totally right. And you look at the numbers. I'm a nerd, so I dive deep into the numbers. He has fewer unique donors at this point in the election than he did in 2020. On every metric, he's declining. He's desperate for money. And I don't believe for a second that he actually raised $50 million. I need to see those receipts. And I wouldn't even believe those receipts, because this is a guy who committed massive financial fraud time and time again. Yeah. His entire life, he's been cooking the books and maintaining two sets of books. So I don't trust his numbers. This guy is desperate for money. That's why he's selling Bibles. I mean, my goodness.
This is a guy who stole from American veterans with a fraudulent online university. He had to pay $26 million in education fraud for stealing from Americans. He had to pay $2 million for charity fraud. I mean, these aren't opinions. This is stuff he's done. How do you explain the fact that this man has such a cult-like power over these white people that stealing from veterans is not a deal breaker any more than G-ing women by the pee was a deal breaker for all those good, faithful Christians?
I love that. I love the way that you said that. I think it's because they just hate the same people, and an intensity of that hate transcends all their considerations. You know what I mean?
I agree.
The bigotry is just the catalyst. It's just their unifier, ironically. Like, their divisiveness is their unifier. They're united in their vehement hate. And their anger, and it's just, I don't know. I would hate to live like that.
I know.
And how do I know Trump's a psychopath? I would never be able to fall asleep if I had, not just one, but four criminal trials and 88 criminal charges. Like, how do you fall asleep? And he managed to do it not once, but twice. Like, any other normal person would be in full on panic mode. Like, I know I would be in a meltdown if that happened to me. I wouldn't even get that far, but he just doesn't care. He just doesn't get, are we allowed to curse? We can't curse.
It's encouraged.
Really?
It's encouraged. The house that Stern built. Yes. You're not in Stephanie Miller's ghetto anymore, lady. You're allowed to be as filthy as you want here. Please.
We couldn't. She even had a beep noise.
Who told you that?
No, we weren't allowed to curse on the radio.
On Stephanie Miller's show?
No.
Oh, you can curse here. This is SiriusXM. We people pay a lot of money to be able to hear you swear. I promise.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I was just going to say, he doesn't give a flying fuck about anything. He mm-hmm. doesn't care so... He cares so little that he's able to fall asleep. Like, no, any other normal person would be complete suffering from the pangs of their conscience.
Well, maybe some would, but I think there's plenty that wouldn't. But with the sleeping, what I found most remarkable, Lindy, wasn't that he fell asleep in court the first day or the second day, but that after the second time he fell asleep, Anchors on Fox News began talking about it. That was the biggest surprise of the trial for me, that Fox News on cameras were mentioning his narcolepsy.
Oh, my goodness. That's the damn
Newsmax
breaking
never
right
did,
there.
But they're talking about it on Fox right now, which means it's permeating the reality just a bit for these people.
You're totally right. That's a really good point. I don't watch Fox, so I never would have realized had you told me.
Oh, well, you're missing so much culture. I watch it all the time, but only because I'm a thinker. You tweeted out the other day something great.
All of these dictators
have a vested interest in returning Trump to power. For his chaotic regime would give authoritarianism and terrorism free reign with absolutely no respect for national sovereignty and human dignity. Lindy, I'm looking at the worst dictators in the world. I'm looking at murderers like Putin, murderers like Kim Jong-un, murderers like the Saudi royal family. They all can't wait to get more of this guy. Netanyahu, who is starving civilians, women and children to death as a means of war, really wants this guy back. I'm pretty sure the Iranian Ayatollahs want this guy back as well, because a functioning, calm America is not in their interest. An America run by this racist clown who is so malleable with a compliment is in the interest of all oppositional nations.
That was a very beautiful turn of phrase. Malleable with a compliment. Wow, John.
I mean,
you're
that's how they do it. That's how they do it.
You're totally right, though. Trump will listen to anyone who's willing to compliment him and say nice things. He's a two-year-old criminal. And it's frightening because you can see it happening. The Saudis and they're slashing oil production with OPEC. Russians are always interfering in our elections. It's never stopped. I mean, come on. It's been ongoing. It's an ongoing operation. They're terrorizing our ally, Ukraine. The Russians are in cahoots with Iran. Kim Jong-un, I mean, so much is going on, but I don't know if you guys have noticed, he's escalating his threats of war against the United States. All these foreign powers are coming out of the woodwork to reelect their boy. Because Trump at the helm would keep America weak, not even weak, but like sick and poor. And did you see that he's threatening to his economic policies? I think it was somebody came out today, Larry Summers, whom I don't even actually usually agree with. He said that Trump's policies will send us into an inflationary spiral. So for all these Republicans bitching about inflation, Trump's going to make it even worse.
You're exactly right. And what's interesting is, let me quote you again from Twitter. You said, let me get this straight. Trump destroyed the Iran nuclear deal and is now complaining about Iran's aggression. He destroyed the border deal and is now complaining about the border. He destroyed the peaceful transfer of power and is now complaining about election integrity. Got it. I'm retweeting that because it's so brilliant. But it speaks to the fact of why is his cult so impervious to facts, reason, basic empathy, and morality. I've kind of thought, and I want to get your opinion on it, that his cult is a lot like him. If you tell them what they want to hear and flatter them, it's going to make them happy and release some dopamine in their brain, and they'll feel like you've done something for them. I mean, just as, you know, these other foreign dictators flatter Donald Trump to get what they want, Donald Trump comes out and tells the shittiest racist people that you're just fine and that you are real America and everybody else is not real America. And people will reward that. If you are going to feed someone's worst sides and validate the ugliest parts of the human id, that's pretty seductive to people. People don't want to hear about the better angels of our nature. They want to be told that you're fine as shitty as you are right now. Am I wrong about this? It seems like this is a core secret of his appeal. He doesn't ask people to be any better than they already are.
Oh, you're totally right. And I guess, again, I think they're united in heat. Nothing else matters. That's transcendent. It's the overarching driver behind their pathos. It's it. That's, you know, they just, the America that we're becoming frightens them. It frightens the shit out of them. So they do anything to go back to the 1950s. Actually, not even the 1950s. With the Arizona abortion ban, they're clearly taking us back to the time of the Civil War. Back when slavery was still around and back when Arizona wasn't even a state. And back when Abraham Lincoln was still president. So long
before women had the right to vote. And as Secretary Clinton pointed out this week, the actual guy who wrote that law in 1864 had four wives and two of them were 15. So that's who we are leaning on.
I did not know that. That is just, wow, nauseating.
Yeah, good times. But let me ask you, you mentioned abortion rights, and I think that's going to be the biggest thing driving turnout, maybe even bigger than Donald Trumping on the ballot. We're now hearing that Nevada may have abortion rights on their ballot as well, which is very thrilling. Looking at this happening in Arizona, looking at this happen in Florida, this is going to be the big game changer for the Democrats. Having stuff like abortion on the ballot to be enshrined in a state constitution, or even just decriminalized weed, as Florida also has, that's going to turn people out to vote more than any speech Joe Biden can give and more than any poll will read. Do you agree?
Who's listening? I'm kind of on, well, I'm on Biden's team. So I want to say that his speeches are so great, you know, that'll definitely be the catalyst to get everyone to the polls. But I think his speeches are great.
But John, I think it's the rights that have been taken away. Yeah.
Yeah, I fully concede that you're right, because abortion rights, it hits on something so intimate and so fundamental. If we don't have control over our bodies, nothing else matters.
Yeah.
I just can't believe this is happening. And hell hath no fury as millions of women whose rights have been stolen. They've been stolen. And just think about it. A rapist appointed a third of the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Let the magnitude of this craziness sink in. And not only that, he installed an alleged sexual predator who triggered 4,500 tips to the FBI.
Yeah.
4,500 tips that Bill Barr subsequently hid. The 4,500 tips that Chris Wray completely ignored and never had an investigation about. And then they appointed former member of People of Praise. I kid you not, People of
That's
Praise.
Right.
It's
That's
a religious right. cult. And I'm Christian, man. So this is not me being like anti-Christian or anything like that. People can believe whatever they want. I don't really care. Just like keep it to yourself and stop forcing it down everyone's throats. And
why not try
being a good person? Instead of like being a cesspool of hate for a change, you know?
I agree. The Christian argument's my favorite.
Yeah. If you don't want an abortion, don't get one. If you don't want to marry a gay person, don't marry a gay person. No one's forcing you to marry a gay person, you know? Like, just leave people alone. Honestly, it's better for your mental health if you leave people alone. And one last thing.
Yeah,
and one thing I want to say about it is I think they replaced Christian. Evangelicalism with Trump. Trump is their new God,
yes,
which is why they're so tenaciously holding on to this dude.
Yeah, I think, well, I actually believe that starting in the late 1970s, they took two generations and replaced the teachings of Jesus with criminalizing abortion. And you know, persecuting gay people and hating migrants to a lesser extent, but criminalizing abortion has displaced and replaced the teachings of Jesus for conservative Christianity over the last two centuries. And I feel like, yeah, Donald Trump has become Jesus to followers of Jesus who don't much care for or know the actual liberal teachings of Jesus.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And you know, you're totally right about the abortion thing. It's their idol. They worship at the altar of forced birth, honestly.
Yeah.
And I can't even step into a church anymore. I grew up in suburban Pennsylvania. So, you know, it's like evangelical land. I can't even believe it. I used to go to Creation Festival and I Googled Creation Festival in the middle of the night the other night. The guy in charge was arrested for sexual assault. And I'm just like, this reinforces everything. You destroyed my childhood, essentially. So thanks a lot. But like beyond that, it just reinforces every stereotype. And it's just so disgusting what they did to religion. It was a beautiful thing for me.
I know. Well, like I always say, I don't blame Jodie Foster for what her crazy fans do. So I try not to blame Jesus for what his crazy fans do.
Speaking of Jodie Foster, I just finished the fourth season of True Detective. Really good.
She's great in it. And to your rapist point, you know, this is a rapist who has made it possible for rapists to pick out the mothers of their children in many different states. And there are American citizens who are going to be forced by government to be pregnant against their will by rape because of the choices of Donald Trump, rapist. This is the kind of language I want to hear Democrats use, Lindy. I want to hear them say R word and take it seriously.
Can I just say thank you, John? Thank you so much. Because one time I was on cable TV, I called him a rapist. You can Google it right now. Daily Mail. I was on the front page of Daily Mail. They completely shamed me for calling him a rapist, for telling the truth.
Yeah.
And
I know, I love
that,
those folks.
I don't want to name names, but that network said it was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. But
yeah, you should have called him a sexual abuser. Sexual abuser, Lindy. It's so much more respectable.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on. Let's be fair. He's a sexual abuser of women.
You got to cut this rapist some slack, you know, is what they're essentially doing. But it's great to be on no one's payroll but my own. Mm-hmm. I tell the truth. I am beholden to no one but the truth.
No, you're fearless. That's one thing I'll say about you. Let's talk to a couple of listeners. A lot of our Evil Army of the Night want to weigh in and say hi.
Oh, my gosh, I've never done this.
Oh, let's do it. Mitch in Kent State. You've been on hold forever. Welcome. You're on Sirius XM with Lindy Lee. How are you, Mitch?
Thank you, John. How are you doing, Lindy?
Hi. You're my first caller ever, like, in my life. So please be nice.
This guy's nice.
Thanks, John.
Well, we'll see.
Appreciate the pub. First, real quick, John, if I may say about the Dickie Betts, Eat a Peach, one of the greatest double album sets of all time, back in 1971. And
rest
that
in peace.
Long jam of Donovan's First There's a Mountain, just a great tune, and God bless Dickie Betts. John, what I was going to really call about was this the intimidation of the jurors.
Intimidation of the jurors, indeed. Please, talk to me.
Well, times have changed, I understand, with social media and, you know, all the other factors now that, you know, we didn't have, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Do you see, I mean, especially with the new other trials coming up now, and these other trials be even more intense, even more, bigger and, I don't know, just... Even more.
That's why I think, Lindy, you know, the karma gods, we should thank for making the Alvin Bragg trial the one people took the least seriously, for making that the first. I think the Jack Smith election interference trial is the most important court case in our country's history. I'm kind of glad that one is not the first one out of the gate.
Oh, you're so right. It's just funny how the universe works out like that. And I also want to point out that the people leading these prosecutions are the people that Trump hates the most. How lucky are we in that?
Yeah.
Like, the irony just cannot get any sharper. You have Alvin Bragg, a double Harvard graduate, an African-American, like, legend, and Tish James, another black attorney general who is absolutely fearless and tenacious, and whom Trump labeled racist. And then you have Fani Willis, who has an indomitable spirit, also an African-American, the very group that Trump attacks again and again. And then you have Shay Moss and Ruby Freeman. This is just like perfect. Like no TV creator would be able to write a script like this. They would be like, oh, this is like too on their nose.
But it's also about the hypocrisy and the lies, too. And Mitch, back me up on this, because Trump's coming out there claiming that this is all persecution of Joe Biden, who is so feeble, and yet he controls this network, this mastermind, to try and take me down. And in reality, it's not Joe Biden indicting him at all. It is grand juries of American citizens who have reviewed the evidence. That's who's handing down the indictments. But again, this is another point I don't hear the media reinforcing. Donald Trump is allowed to set this narrative, and mainstream corporate media lets it hang there in the air.
Exactly. And the other thing, John, the other thing about this trial, it's almost like a mob boss trial. It's like, you know,
very much so.
A mafioso type trial. You know, this whole narrative. I mean, as far as the other cases that are coming up, I mean, I'm just worried about these jurors. I mean, so much pressure, I think, on them.
I agree.
Is it right? I mean, because there's social media that they can actually, you know, delve into their history, to their background, because it's different now. I mean, jury a long time ago, but, you know, it wasn't nothing like this. I mean, but still, just to have your life exposed, like, I understand they know what they're getting into, I guess, more or less, you know, but...
Well, we'll see. I hope they do.
Yeah, for sure.
I hope they do. I mean, Lindy, what do you make of this? You were talking earlier about that we've just witnessed essentially jury tampering right out in the open with just enough plausible deniability for this guy. I think no judge wants to put him in jail and revoke his bail for the weekend. I think he'd fundraise off of it. He'd use it as an excuse to try to get a mistrial. But I mean, is it fair to say that we're witnessing jury tampering happening in real time and Donald Trump is retweeting just enough to encourage it?
Oh, absolutely. It's like shamelessly. He's doing it shamelessly out in the open because he knows that he's not going to get punished for it. To your point, no judge wants to make him a martyr because that's exactly what he wants. No one wants to play into his hands. And it's just obscene, though. But because he's gotten away with everything, he escalates his actions. It's gotten worse. He was threatening the prosecutors, Jack Smith and his James and Fani Willis. And now he's going after the witnesses now. After a few weeks ago, he literally posted a picture of President hogtied in the back of a truck.
Right.
Yeah. No one did a thing. I'm actually stunned that no one from the Justice Department came out and said anything. It's like people are just normalizing it and just.
I mean, I don't know if they're normalizing it. I think they're choosing their battles carefully. I think he's looking for any excuse to claim that his free speech rights have been attacked and that people are coming after him, trying to take him down because he's just here trying to fight for you. I mean, their whole gig is victimhood, perpetual white male victimhood. And that's what he's selling on this campaign. And I think you're seeing a lot of people in authority trying to deny him that chance, even if it's not satisfying in the moment.
Yeah, but even the Republican Party, not a single Republican in a position of power said anything about Trump posting a picture of President Biden. It's just so obscene.
They're all cowards. Even Romney saying that there's no grounds to impeach Mayorkas, and then he votes for it anyway. They're all just cowards.
Exactly.
Mitch, I'll give you the last word, Mitch.
I'm sorry, but I just want to say, if there'd been anybody else, Joe Sixpack, whatever we call him, do any of this shenanigans, even, you know, one-fifth of the shenanigans, they'd be in jail already.
Exactly.
You know, I think how much leash does this guy get? You know, I think he should have been at least fined or whatever a long time ago. He's just you know, playing the system, playing us, you know.
Mitch. Thank you for the call, Mitch. We got to go. And Miss Lindy Lee, I'm so glad we were finally able to do this. I hope now you've seen we're harmless. We can get you back more often here on the Love Fest.
Oh, absolutely. That was really therapeutic and exactly what I needed after a long day. John, you Miss are Lee, hilarious. I knew you were before, now. But now I've witnessed it firsthand.
Oh, go on. No, you're going to see me live on stage doing what I really do in 2 weeks. So we'll see what you think after that. You might not speak to me anymore after you witness my set. But you're going to join us on stage with JoJo from Jurs and Glenn Kirshner in Philly on Saturday, the 27th.
My number one goal is not to fall over my heels. So,
and my number one goal is to not fall asleep. I'm going to try not falling asleep on stage during the show because apparently that's frowned on now. Lindy, how do we follow you, Miss Lee?
Oh, Lindy Lee, LindyLi. Thank you. So I'm a late night tweeter. So any night owls out there. I'm perfect.
Oh,
for you.
Great. We're going to call you for this 11 o'clock hour a few more times then, Lindy. Thank you very much for classing up our show. We got to hit a break. Guys, we'll be right back with your calls in just a moment. This is Progress. Don't go away.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
And welcome back. This is Progress. We're at 866-997-4748. I spend all week waiting for this segment. The God Squad has descended, and they are among us now. Keith Giles is a former pastor who left the pulpit to follow Jesus. He's the author of the best-selling 7-part Jesus Un book series, with titles like Jesus Untangled, Crucifying Our Politics to Pledge Allegiance to the Lamb, or Jesus Unarmed. He writes great books, and he's a regular contributor to the Patheos Progressive Christian blog platform and the co-owner of Choir Publishing. And I had the great pleasure of being on a podcast taping of his just last week in New York. Keith, welcome back to SiriusXM.
I am so glad to be back, John, and I look forward to this every week as well.
All right on. I look forward to getting to spend some time with Pastor December Rose, former pastor of the Restoration Center in Greenville, South Carolina, and the Rock Worship Center in West Union, South Carolina. She's the author of The Church Can Go to Hell, a jaw-dropping memoir and theological dive into the toxic reality of church culture. She's also an amazing spoken word artist. Pastor Rose, I am so happy to have you with us.
Hey, Boo. I'm glad to be here every week.
Thank you. Just to be called Boo by you. And finally, Dylan Cruz is a writer, a theologian, a permaculture enthusiast in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. His book, Theological Musings, Volume 1, is a terrific collection of essays on environmental concerns, social and political concerns. He is also the official left-wing Christian former veteran of SiriusXM Progress. Mr. Cruz, it's good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure, John. Thanks for having us.
Dylan, let me start with you. Can you? I want to set up a clip I'm going to play. Can you tell us a little bit about this guy, Pastor Joel Webbon? I know he's the president and founder of Right Response Ministries and the senior pastor of Covenant Bible Church, but I don't really know much more about him beyond the official title. What do you know about this hero of Christian values?
Well, he's deep in the Christian nationalist movement. He was one of the authors of the statement on Christian nationalism in the gospel that I brought up a few weeks ago. He's recently said that he doesn't want women to have the vote, because if women have the vote, then we will no longer have a Christian country. So if you look him up on YouTube, he's full of lots of batshit insane, very highly patriarchal, controlling fundamentalist fuckwittery.
Well, and I mean, you set this clip up better than I could. This is the clip that you just referenced. This is that guy, Joel Webbon. And by the way, I want to say, in preparation for this segment, I followed him on Twitter about 15 minutes ago. Within 5 minutes, he had blocked me. So I didn't even say anything. I'm so honored. This is that guy, Joel Webbon, being interviewed by this guy from Heritage, William Wolfe, talking about the statement on Christian nationalism manifesto that was drafted by Oklahoma Senator Dusty Devers. And here is Joel Webbon saying what women could do if he had the power. Give a listen.
Let's say you can wave your Christian nationalist wand. We wake up tomorrow in a Christian nation, a Christian nationalist nation, as you're describing, all right? There's a lot of fears that people have. Here's one of them. Will women have the right to vote tomorrow if you wave that magic Christian wand?
No.
Okay, why not? I want to get into why not. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Because if we had a Christian nation tomorrow and women did have the right to vote, we would not have a Christian nation within 50 years.
Okay, elaborate a little bit on that.
Because the husband has been appointed by God as the head of his home, and no-fault divorce and women's suffrage, more than anything else, ultimately split the household.
I think what unites these Christian nationalists the most is their incredible ability to go straight from the ugliest parts of the Old Testament, skip everything Jesus said, and go straight to the misogyny of St. Paul and the acid hallucinations of Book of Revelation. Pastor Rose, let me begin with you. Wouldn't it be great if we could be more Christian and you lost your say in democracy? Wouldn't that be just everything that Jesus talked about?
What's this guy's name again?
Joel Webbon.
Joel Webbin.
Fuck yeah. Joel Webbin. Let me just say that with the utmost sincerity and conviction in my heart. Fuck him and the horse that he rode in on, too. But after that, what planet? First of all, this whole thing about the hierarchy of God being so fragile that a woman voting could topple it at any moment. Suffrage. What do you say? Women's suffrage. He said no fault divorce. This sounds to me like he want to go back to the days when women was trapped off in these marriages and couldn't get out.
Yes.
Because if he's talking about going back to a time when women couldn't vote and a woman couldn't get, he's talking about a dangerous time for women and a definitely a dangerous time for a black woman. Just black people in general. There ain't no time that he's talking about going back to that I want to go back to. If he's talking about going back to that. And when he mentioned, you got to think about the mindset. And did you hear how quick he said, how quickly he responded? He didn't even think about it. That means this thing been ruminating and marinating and, you know, in his spirit for a minute. He didn't even have to think about
his answer. This guy hates women. I've looked him up a little bit. He really hates women. Y'all be thinking
he loves them in the box that he want to put them in. But if it got to do with having a job, getting divorced from an abusive husband or voting, then he hates your ass. So he pretty much hates every woman, this modern day woman. Because he said, no, I thought about that. Did you hear him say no fault divorce? Mm-hmm. So is he literally saying that if a woman decides that she doesn't want to be married anymore, that's part of the breakdown of the nation too?
Yeah, you're trapped in an abusive marriage. Yeah, it's too easy for women to get away from men who beat them up. That's what he's saying.
He's literally saying that. And also, I'm thinking, I don't know what kind of, we don't serve, apparently we don't believe in the same God. Because the God that I believe in is too powerful to have his order, such as whatever you think it is, be subject to being dismantled by a woman voting. I don't understand. And there's right so on. Many of
Great
them.
Point.
When you think about any of these extremist people and fundamentalists, whether it's Christian, whether it's Islam, whether it's, it doesn't matter which one, the oppression of women is a common thread in their tapestry. It don't matter which
one. That's it.
And that ought to tell you something. All of it don't matter which religion, it's that's one of the factors
that's
in all of
it. One of the tenets. Extreme conservative Muslims, extreme conservative Jews, extreme conservative Christians. The more to the right your faith group is, the more women are second class citizens in every religion I can think of except Scientology. Keith, let me ask you something. I kind of love this guy because I think there's a lot of legislators in Congress and people at Fox News who feel exactly the same way, but they are smart and astute enough to not say that part out loud. I love these godless, evil, incel motherfuckers who can't keep their misogyny contained and show us what the movement really feels. I kind of want to make this guy famous and let him be a face of the party more than I want to beat him down.
Right. Well, I will say, you know, it's not really a secret that his email address is joel@covenantbible.org. If anyone listening wanted to send him an encouraging message. But I will agree with you. I will agree with you that
encourage him to play in rush hour traffic.
Yeah, but here's the thing, though. Hopefully this isn't too like inside baseball for people. But like he said in that clip, right, that, again, you know, the Bible says that that the man is the head of the wife or the man is the head of the home. And not that really evangelical Christians care about what the scriptures actually say. They're so willing to just like read a single verse, quote it, shut the Bible, walk away. They don't want to get into what it really says. Does it really mean that? So this is, again, one of these examples where actually, if you really look into the Greek of this text, it's from Ephesians chapter 5. And it's actually right there, even in most English translations. It actually, if you read carefully, you can see it's actually right in plain sight. It doesn't mean head as in the sense as he's using it, and most evangelical Christians use it when it says that the man is the head of the wife. We typically read it as that means the man is the boss, right? The head is the boss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in the first century, when people thought of the head, physiologically, what they were thinking of is the head is where you get nourishment. It's where your mouth is. It's where you eat things and you nourish your body. Now, here's the clue. Where it says that, Ephesians 5:23, Paul says, for the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church. Okay. Then you skip down and then it goes to the men. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies, as Christ loved the church, and they should feed and care for their wives as they do their own body, just as Christ does the church. So Paul says, in the same way, you know, that this is the Christ in the church is the head. Then it finishes the idea with, and what does that mean as the head? You're feeding and nourishing your wife as
well,
Christ
okay,
feeds and nourishes the church.
Yeah.
And so they don't mean that. They don't mean it the way Paul meant it. What he really meant, he didn't mean it as the boss. He meant it as someone who cares for and nourishes and takes and you know shows attention for, not as the boss. And so again, it's not that they care about that, but just for some clarification, that's what it actually says.
Well, Dylan, let me bring it back to you because again, he's quoting Paul. These right wingers never quote Jesus. They can't ever quote Jesus. They don't fight for any of the teachings of the guy whose name they attach on this religion. And I find that very telling time and time again.
Well, absolutely. If you look at Jesus's ministry and his words, there's a lot of complex stuff going on there.
Yeah.
And some of it I don't agree with.
Yeah.
But here's a fun fact. Jesus didn't agree with everything in his Bible either.
Right. That's right.
That's why he so often said, "You have heard it said, but I say this." Right. And then he overturned some stuff that he didn't like. But here's a point that I want to make. Ephesians was almost certainly not written by Paul.
Right.
That's true.
Pseudepigrapha.
Yeah.
Yes. Pseudepigrapha. Deuteropauline is what it is. If you read a passage out of a Dickens novel, and then you read a passage out of Old Man and the Sea by Hemingway.
Yeah.
They're both in the English language, but Dickens is writing these long-ass sentences with $12 words that I just love, and Hemingway is writing these short little rat-a-tat sentences that I can't stand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how scholars tend to look at these letters and say, one of these is not like the other.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, look, we could talk about biblical inconsistencies all day. It's one of my favorite things. But can I ask you guys, I want to get to callers, but let me just ask one more question about the whole divorce thing. You know, the Catholic Church was against it for many years. Before Mother Teresa died, she went to Ireland to argue in her frail state against lifting that country's ban on divorce. And my take has always been, And tell me if this is blasphemous, but like I always take Matthew 19, where Jesus throws out the Moses divorce laws. You know, under Moses, if you no longer delight in your wife, you can kick her to the curb.
Right.
Which in those days was a death sentence for women. If a woman's husband kicked her out and she didn't have a family to go live with, her alternatives were prostitution or homelessness, right?
Yeah. Or begging.
So I've always viewed Jesus as being a feminist standing up for women in Matthew 19.
Yes.
He actually begins it, that whole bit about if you look with lustful looks, you've already committed adultery in your heart. I always thought he's saying, don't sexually harass these women in the market. Stop leering at them, you dicks. And if you're married to someone and you dump her for no reason, then you've made an adulterer out of her. I've always thought this is Jesus standing up for women, because back then, divorce could be a death sentence. Cut to 2,000 years later, being trapped in an abusive marriage could be a death sentence. So my big hypothetical, because y'all are smarter than me.
And it is a death sentence for many
women.
Do
you think Jesus would still say that today? Would Jesus still be that conservative today? Or would he say, no, ladies, get away if you're being abused?
No, I think you're right. I think the spirit of what Jesus is saying, to your point, John, what Jesus is attempting to do in that passage is to give women freedom, to set them free from the oppression that they were under by this very, you know, abusive law that that allowed the men to just to divorce them at will in an economy where they had no means to take care of themselves or their children. And so Jesus is intending to, you know, modify that so that it sets them free. And so now to use that same sentence from Jesus' mouth to put women back under bondage to an abusive husband, to me, that is wrong. I think Jesus in our context would say to women that are being abused, get out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and here's 100%. The thing, too. Go ahead.
Please, go ahead.
Here's the thing, too, that they skip over. First of all, in a lot of Holy Ghost roller Bible thumping fools like to pick and cherry pick what scriptures fit whatever bullshit they want to come out of their mouth with. But Ephesians 5, they skip right to verse 22, wives, submit yourselves to your husband.
Yes.
They skip right over verse 21 that says submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God.
It's a mutual submission.
It's mutual.
It starts with that. before it gets to what wives are supposed to do and what husbands supposed to do. It starts with submitting yourselves. Well, that's Ephesians 5:21. They skip clean over that and go to wives.
Damn, you're right.
Like, it ain't even there. I have hardly ever heard a pastor.
I've never heard husbands submit to your wives. Never heard husbands submit to your wives. I only hear the other way.
Submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord.
So true.
But here's the part about why I believe anybody that says all this stuff is full of shit, they're not hearing from the Lord, and they certainly aren't operating in the Holy Spirit. Because even if you read this verbatim, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church and he is the savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands. Let's say you read all that, and then you go to verse 25. Husbands, this is deep right here. Love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. This is super deep. This is some kind of love, okay? That he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having a spot or a wrinkle. Now, how can you present your wife glorious if she got a dent and a scratch and a bruise and a cut and a black eye and all this other kind of thing going on? But if you're loving her like Christ loved the church, that kind of shit ain't happening. If you're loving her like Christ loved the church, there isn't any emotional abuse. There isn't verbal abuse, and there sure in the hell and ain't no physical abuse. And so all these men want to be talking about submission, submission, submission. Motherfucker, I ain't got to submit to you unless you're submitted to God.
Yeah.
And I can tell if you're submitted to God or not based on how you're treating me. Because if you're not treating me like Christ treated the church, you can fuck yourself. Okay, I don't have, and this is the thing. This is the thing that even if you go by the word verbatim as it is written, and you believe this as it is with no type of interpretation, there shouldn't be an abused woman on the planet under Christianity. There shouldn't be a misused, mistreated, oppressed woman on the planet under Christianity. If you just go by this verbatim by the red letters. Yes. Every woman under Christianity should be well loved, well cared for, well provided for, considered, being treated with gentleness, respected, loved.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If they actually believe this word, but they don't. They're full of shit. They don't believe this word. Or else you wouldn't be trying to tell a woman who's being abused she got to stay in a marriage. You wouldn't be trying to tell a woman who's being verbally abused, physically abused, or oppressed, you got to stay there. You would be saying, God said he ought to love you like the church, boo. If he can't do that, bounce.
That's right.
And in fairness to these Christian nationalists, they're not big on democracy for men either. Okay, we have callers. You want to talk to some of our evil army of the night?
Yeah.
Come on. With
happy to come back to this topic. But Mark is on the line from South Dakota. Mark, thank you for your patience on hold. You're on with the God Squad.
Hey, thanks for having me. My question is... Well, to be honest, it's less scripture than it is the intersection of policy and religion in general.
Okay.
And I wanted to know what your guys' take would be as to whether or not, like, would you be supporting churches being taxed? Like, say, for, like,
good
maybe
question.
You start with, like, say, maybe and if so, at what, like, rate? Do you start at $1 or do you start at $1 million or somewhere in
between. That's an even better question. Yeah. Dylan, you want to take this one first?
Well, I know some churches already pay tax because there are Mennonite churches locally here in Lancaster County that pay taxes. But here's the thing, and I see this a lot, and I just want to caution this, we should tax all the churches. A lot of churches are combining multiple congregations in one building. They can barely afford to pay their bills. Pastors used to be a full-time job. Now they're
not for little churches, but these gigantic corporate
mega churches. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Tax Joel Osteen back to the fucking Stone Age.
Here's what I find so fascinating is American Christians, especially, like, they act as if this idea of tax exemption for pastors and churches is somewhere in the Bible. When Jesus says, pay your taxes, when Paul says, pay your taxes, but they act like, oh no, we're Christians and we shouldn't have to pay our taxes. I mean, to Dylan's point, I had a friend of mine several years ago, and he had this great idea. He was actually going to introduce legislation. He wanted to try to find someone who would help him introduce legislation to do exactly this, to tax churches. But this was the caveat, and I think this is the way we should do it if we were to do it. if a church could demonstrate that in their community, they actually were a benefit to their community. They were providing after-school programs. They were taking care of the homeless and the poor in their community. They could demonstrate that they were actually, you know, giving back to the people in their community.
You're
they were actually serving them. Then they could keep their tax-exempt status. But if they were taking that money and building bowling alleys and basketball courts and buying a big giant plasma TV screen for the, you know, for the coffee shop in the back or whatever, then no. That church does not get to keep its tax-exempt status because it can't demonstrate that they're actually doing any good for the rest of the community. And that's what I would
But isn't the tricky part here when people talk about, well, my church it does a lot for charity, but that's kind of subjective what that means. For a lot of people, my church doing a lot for charity means my church pays for buses to go to Washington, D.C. and demand women don't have abortion rights and to scream at women outside clinics. And I don't necessarily think that's community service. Dylan, I cut you off. Go ahead, please.
No, I think whatever Keith's friend said is absolutely brilliant. If churches are following the injunctions of Christ and their congregants are being spiritually nourished and their pastors aren't rolling up in a Bentley like December said last week, you know, then leave them be.
Yeah.
But these John Hagee and Kenneth Copeland, and I have to have a private jet to get to my next ministry gig.
Right?
Bullshit. Jesus had sandals, my dude. He had his Jerusalem cruisers, and he was walking around without food and shit.
Yeah.
I think he'd have upgraded to a city bus pass by now, but yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah.
You know, he said, if you come to a town, you stay in the house the whole time you're there. And you eat and you drink and you do the thing. And then if they don't want you, then shake the dust off and roll.
Yeah.
Keep it moving.
Hey, Mark, thank you so much for the call. Really smart one. And I love that topic because, yeah, little rinky-dink churches, God bless them. They need all the help they can get. But these businesses, I mean, with all due respect to Pastor Osteen, when they find hundreds of thousands of dollars hidden in the walls of the bathroom in your mega church because you don't want to pay tax on it, or whatever the reason was, let me go to Mike in Michigan. Mike, you're on with the God Squad. Thanks for waiting on hold.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I've learned so much from you guys. It's amazing.
They're great.
About Jonathan and David and Naomi and Ruth and things like that. Just amazing stuff. I just want for these fundamentalists like Mike Johnson and want to bring on the end of the world soon because they think if they keep doing what they're doing, they're going to bring on. I really think they're trying to bring on the end of the world. But
yes, they are.
But the scripture gets to me. It's like Donald Trump would say, 1 Corinthians. It's in 1 Corinthians 15:52. Well, 51 says, "Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall be changed in the twinkling of an eye at the last trump." And not talk about Donald Trump or like Trump Jr. But at the last trump, if they saw that, I mean, wouldn't they understand that the last trump in the book of Revelations is way past the tribulation? So they think they're going to be caught up in the air before the fourth trumpet, okay?
Right.
The last trumpet to sound
and
is the seventh.
It's all just Bible fan fiction. I mean, rapture.
But there's prophecy in the Bible, I believe, that brought me to believe in Jesus Christ. When Psalm 22 says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That brought me to my knees and made me believe this 800-year prophecy came to pass when Jesus died on the cross and King David was in the spirit saying these words.
But the scribes have rewritten these texts hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, and edits were made to make things fulfill prophecies, whether it made sense or not. I mean, if you want to get technical about it, I don't know if you can really call Jesus the Messiah.
If you look at
not according to the Hebrews.
Well, the only thing I did want to share a quick story.
Well, do you have a question for the? Do you have a question for the for our experts here?
Yeah, I have a question.
I'm wondering what you thought.
Compared to me, you're experts. Go ahead, Mike.
of the rapture, you know? I mean,
yeah.
I believe
we missed it. The eclipse came, and we're all still here, so we were not qualified.
The Lord's coming a second time, okay? And I don't believe it's going to happen like the three Hebrew children, when they were thrown in the fire, you know, like a tribulation, the only thing that were burned on them was their bonds. So we can go through it if we need to. I mean, that's up to the Lord.
Let me turn this over to the squad to comment on this, because you've handed us a lot to think about here, and we're hitting a break in a couple of minutes. Keith?
I'll just quickly say, this will just blow your mind a little bit. I used to believe exactly what you just said for the longest time. But I looked into actually all these, quote unquote, the rapture scriptures and the return, those words, when Paul uses those words, it's parousia, it just means presence. Jesus says, here's something to think about that'll blow your mind. Jesus says in the Gospel of John that if anyone loves Christ, he says, I will come, my Father and I will come and make our home in you now. So I think there's a good case to be made that Christ has already returned, quote unquote, in his presence in everyone, like Acts, when the Spirit of God is poured out on all flesh. We are now the second coming of Christ. You and I are now the incarnation of Christ in the world today. And that's a different way of reading some of those texts, but I think actually it's a better way to read it. I wrote a book on this called Jesus Unexpected, and it's ending the end times to become the second coming. I think that we've missed what it's trying to say.
That's great. Yeah. I think you touched something there. When the bride has made herself ready, which is the church, okay, that's when the bridegroom will come. Okay, and I believe if you make yourself ready for Christ, I guess the bridegroom's already here.
Right. Yes. Exactly.
Pastor Rose.
Look.
Well, I take a Pascal's wager toward that, but I did used to also believe that. But I will say this: I try to not trivialize anybody's faith or belief system or set of values. I would just say this: if that is what you believe, that is fine. There's nothing wrong with that, right? If that's what you believe, if it's going to cause you to live upright in the earth, to love your brother, to be a good person, to do good work, to do charity, to help the widow, to help the orphan, to whatever the case, if it's going to cause you to do that until he comes, so be it. I think that's a blessing. I will not trivialize what anyone believes, and you have the right to believe what you will. I say that, fine, believe it. Just don't set a date or time, because he said nobody knows the date or time. He didn't come in the 1940, 1944. Yep. He didn't come the other day when we had the eclipse. Yeah. Just don't be out here on no corner trying to tell people when he's coming.
But that's the problem, December, right?
And you'll be all
right. That's the problem. There's people who don't give a damn. They cannot be bothered with Jesus' inconveniently liberal teachings. They just want to know that they have their after party pass behind God's velvet rope right now. Uh-huh. And that's what they care
not
about.
The backstage pass.
Yeah. Yeah.
They get to go to the after party.
Like he's coming every day. If that's what you believe, just don't try to prophesy the date and time. You'd be all right.
Yeah. Okay. Mike, I thank you very much for the call. Dylan Cruz, I want to go to you about the end of the world.
Yeah, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine, sort of. I want, for Mike in Michigan, a couple of things that he said about prophecies in the Gospels. The Gospels were written by people who relied on the Septuagint, which was a translation of the original biblical Hebrew into common everyday Greek. And some things were lost in translation. Some of those things that the Gospel writers used were retrojections, because they had a narrative to tell. So if they found some things that were attributed to other things by the prophets of the Hebrew Bible, they applied it to Jesus in order to tell a compelling narrative.
Mm.
And the last thing I want to say really quickly is that the book of Revelation is about the Roman Empire. It is about how Christians in the first century should respond to an avaricious, militaristic, hate-filled empire of killers. It is not about the 21st century in the United States of America or Russia or Israel or Syria or any of that stuff. There's no secret code to crack.
Nope.
None of that stuff. John Hagee's made I don't know how much money talking about his blood moons and all that shit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a reason why we're still sitting here tonight, because there's only one verse in the entire New Testament canon that even kind of hints at something called the rapture, and it's in 1 Thessalonians, and it's literally one sentence.
Right.
And that's it.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
And these people, yeah,
it's almost like Jesus was big on, hey, take care of the here and now, like a good Jew, and look out for people and be a mensch, not pray a lot and wait to be treated like you're some special shit when the world blows up after you've done nothing for others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. So stop theological trying laziness. To make the end of the world happen by creating Armageddon in the Middle East.
But that's what they do, right? Mm-hmm. That's why these people support Israel. It's exactly not because they care about Jews. They need Israel there for their Bible fan fiction. So a vengeful, hateful Jesus can show up with a flaming sword and kill half of them and first force the other half to convert.
I'm pretty sure that the reason why so many Christians are against giving aid to Ukraine is that there's probably some back channel thing going, if we just let Russia do some stupid shit, then we can make Armageddon happen. So let's just let Russia do some stupid evil shit so we can get our prophecies fulfilled.
Yeah.
Mm. Keith?
That's my hypothesis.
Yeah, exactly.
Right on.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, this is the thing, you know, totally right, Dylan. It's about Revelation's about Rome, the Mark of the Beast. It's Nero. It's pretty obvious it's Nero. People have known actually for a long time that it's talking about Nero. So it's not anybody in the future. It's not Gorbachev. It's not Obama. It's not, you know, whoever. We keep changing the musical chairs. And then this was something December said. You know, I agree too. Like, I don't really care at the end of the day if Christians think Jesus is coming back tomorrow or next week or whatever, and they set dates and all that stuff. It's, you know, that's up to them. My real concern, I think the real danger of Christians, at least in my experience, who believe that, who really believe that, you know, Jesus is going to come back someday and fix everything, is that it creates an inaction. It makes them just sit around twiddling their thumbs instead of doing the stuff that Jesus asked them to do, which was care for the poor, the orphan, the widow. Like, well, why bother with, you know, taking care of cleaning up the planet? Because Jesus is going to come back and destroy everything anyway.
And by the way, when you say they think Jesus is going to come back and fix everything, you say Jesus is going to come back and fix everything, they mean Jesus is going to come back and kill everyone I don't like and kiss me and anoint me and tell me I was special all along.
That's the Prince
of Peace. December, I'll give you the last word on it.
That's exactly right.
It also creates a religious caste, right?
Yes.
Because we're supposed to be getting, quote, saved from this or whatever the case. And those who are going to go were the ones that were saved. And those who are not were going to get left behind. Y'all remember that whole movie series? Yeah. That whole
We are out of time, I'm afraid. Pastor Rose, how do our listeners follow you and keep up with all of your coolness and work?
December Rose, and that's DESIMBER, and get my book on Amazon.
Dylan, how do we keep up with you, Mr. Cruz?
Tattooed Theologians, my blog. My books are all over Amazon, and I'm on Twitter dropping knowledge.
Right on. And Keith?
Yeah, keithjohns.com is my blog. You can find my books on Amazon and check out Heretic Happy Hour podcast. And anywhere.
I had a great time with you this. Okay, so next week, let's start this at the top of the hour so we can get even more calls. I'm sorry if we didn't get to all of your calls. It's my fault. I like talking to these people way too much. Have a great week, fam. I'll see you next week.